Good evening, everyone. It's great to see all kinds of faces here, new and old. And if you are new to here, we're actually preaching through a series called Garden to Garden. We're actually throughout the course of the year, we will preach through the story of the entire Bible. And many people in our community are reading texts alongside that, reading the Bible text alongside that, so that by the end of the year, they will have gone through it as well. So we right now are in a new stretch of the history that we're going through in the Old Testament, where we're transitioning from a time in Israel's history that we recently covered, where Israel was tribes ruled by judges, and now we're transitioning to a united kingdom in Israel ruled by a single monarch. So this is actually where we're going to be in the series for the next couple weeks. And if you remember, like over across like some of the lessons so far, when Pastor Danielle recently preached on Leviticus, she started it by actually saying that it was her favorite book of the Bible, despite how many people interpret it. And then after that, Kevin preached through Deuteronomy, and he said that was his favorite book of the Bible. And then a couple times later, Pastor Kristen preached through Ruth and said that was her favorite book of the Bible. So naturally, I am going to say, I'm going to tell you now, this is not my favorite books of the Bible. We're actually covering like events across 1st and 2nd Samuel. You'll actually see why throughout our talk, why this is not my favorite book of the Bible. I think it raises tensions in a good way, but it raises good tensions that we will need to work through as a community and as interpreters have been working through for centuries. So and also too, like just when you're talking about like, oh, this is like the birth of the monarchy for Israel. You know, I'm an American, so I have a history of my country being exactly on the opposite side of monarchy. I'm also of South Asian descent, and we also have a history of opposing monarchy. So it's kind of like you read this story, I'm like, who am I supposed to be rooting for here in this in the arc of the story? But we'll kind of talk through that type of tension as well. So despite me saying this is not my favorite stretch of the Old Testament, it is really interesting that the text that we're going through, in Garden to Garden now, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, it really is the most dynamic text within the Old and New Testaments. And by dynamic, I mean like the stuff that's going on, the type of storytelling that's happening, the way the plot moves forward. There are, there's a constant epic military battles going on, just like for chapter after chapter, for entire stretches. There are battles between underdogs and possibly literal giants. There are succession style battles among children over who is going to be the next person in line to be king. People will murder each other over it. There is adultery, romantic subplots. There is, at one point, someone consults a witch who conjures a ghost. That's what we're talking about. And like the range of things that happen across this text, it gets wild. And I love that for you as you read through it. And what I'm going to do today is kind of give you the two big themes to keep in mind as you're trying to make sense of like, okay, across all of these stories, what are those key threads that I should hold on to? And one of those threads that I think is worth like really holding on to starts from something that we've actually like caught in the book of Judges, so the like set of text right before this one, that kind of it's previews this era that we're going to be in for the next several chapters in Israel's history. So this is actually literally the last line of the book of Judges. So before we enter this 1st and 2nd Samuel and this whole stretch, it says, in those days, there was no king in Israel. all the people did what was right in their own eyes. So this type of phrase, like this actually occurs four times in the book of Judges. This is a repeated refrain all towards the end of the book of Judges, basically saying like, hey, as we're, it's like, you know, it is literally a preview. It's saying as we transition out of this period of Judges, which if you were with us through that text, you know that it was a period of like cycles of losing faith in God, disastrous violence, Israel needing salvation, God raising up a judge to try to save Israel, and then like repeating that cycle over and over. In many ways, it is bleak. Like it's an arc that is begging for something in the future that can pull Israel out of this kind of sad, violent cycle. And so, as part of that, as part of like that whisper of like the thing that could pull Israel out of that cycle is this idea of a king. This is a positive statement, like about kings, saying like in those days, part of a big part of the problem of this chaos was there was no king. There was no single person who could unify Israel and then as a whole point Israel towards God to save them. And that's interesting. So we like let's sit with that theme a little bit. This idea that God will use a king to accomplish what God wants to, that God couldn't in other forms of like, you know, government and ruling for Israel up until that point. So the that's kind of the backdrop of Judges. So then the first part of this next stretch of 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings is you meet Samuel the prophet, who the book is named after. And Samuel is actually, he functions in those first several chapters as a prophet and a judge and the military leader of Israel. He actually, and he has like unilateral praise within the text for what he is able to do for Israel. He gets the kind of praise actually that Deborah does as a judge and prophet and military leader in the book of Judges. So it's like this, you know, it's almost setting this up with like, wow, Samuel is a great character who seems like he's able to accomplish those things that God wants to accomplish through Israel. But Samuel's not a king, right? Of all the titles that I just gave for him, that's not him. So in fact, whereas the text will say, Samuel continued as Israel's leader all the days of his life. So that is what he did as ushering in this new era. But as he progressed in his time as in leading Israel, as he got older, then they reached a point in 1 Samuel where the people speak to him and they say, you are old and your sons do not follow in your ways. Appoint for us then a king to govern us like other nations. Okay, and then it continues. We are determined to have a king over us so that we may also be like other nations, that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles. And then, a bit later in the text, the Lord said to Samuel, listen to their voice and set a king over them. So then Samuel sets the stage for a transition in power and a transition in the form of government of Israel. The way, like later on in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, when it was a sermon and the speaker is like glossy, like telling a history of Israel, they kind of succinctly talk about this transition. They say, then they asked for a king and God gave them Saul. So now we have Saul. King Saul, the first king over Israel. And this is our introduction to him in 1 Samuel, okay? It says, Kish had a son named Saul, as handsome as a young man as could be found anywhere in Israel. And he was a head taller than anybody else, okay? So possibly 6'5", possibly brown eyes. Like, this guy is very attractive. It's just a fascinating way to introduce him as your leader for a king. I actually was trying to think through what are the actual like Hebrew words that are used to describe this. What was funny too, in that you realize like in the King James, for example, it describes him, you know, it says Kish had a son whose name was Saul, a choice young man and goodly. And there was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he, which is great. I don't know what a goodly looks like, but I'm assuming based on the artwork that it has inspired for Christians for centuries, it means having furrowed brows that can carry the hopes and dreams of Israel for their future. In fact, it's so funny that like we you know, we really project these ideas of like, look at how like strong and handsome he must have been, where this actual, this way of portraying him actually comes with, this is a scene in 1 and 2 Samuel where King Saul has, that's David, who will be the, spoiler alert, will become the future king, playing the harp to drive out like madness and possible demonic possession from Saul's mind. So this is him just like losing his mind. He's so handsome, even while he's going through this enormous mental anguish. That's how we like our leaders, right? Just big, strong, handsome, tall all the time. Who needs me to objectify Jesus's abs when the text of the Bible will objectify Saul for us? So in that, in that stage, I think it's easy for many of us, like who know about like how the arc of Saul's life goes, to be like, that's like praising his looks is like looking in all the wrong places for leadership. That's fine. We'll get there in a second. But first, you just appreciate that this is who God chose from based on what the people wanted at the time. And this, like, so far, there is this thread where the text really does seem to be speaking very positively about the idea of the monarchy in general, of what a king could accomplish through Israel. It shows up later too. So this again is that same sermon in the New Testament from the book of Acts, reflecting on Israel's history. And it, characterizes it. I have found, this is Saul's successor. So it'll say, I have found David, son of Jesse, a man after my own heart. He will do everything I want him to do. So again, it seems there's this idea where God is happy to work through a king like David to accomplish God's goals. And then in 2 Samuel, this is towards the end of like these like 1 and 2 Samuel stretch. This is when, this is later in King David's reign, where there is a promise that God makes to David that says, when your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So again, that seems like a very like positive portrayal of how kingdoms work. This is God promising to make this monarchy, this type of structure, permanent, like forever. Like that's how the text is describing it. When you see threads like that, and again, you as a 21st century American probably struggle to like, praise the idea of like a monarchy and its benefits the way that there is a thread in this text doing. That also, like, it helps to kind of think through like how novel it is for us, like, as Americans living in the 21st century, to have that type of perspective. So long ago, long before any of us were born, long before America was born, there's this idea, it's very common, called the divine right of kings. So this was actually like the, it is a like political, philosophical, social, and theological justification for like what is the best type of government that people should have. It was actually one of the strongest arguments against the idea of like, Americans who were pro-establishing a democracy. The idea would be like, how on earth could that work when God is the one who established the monarchy? Again, like to you, you're like, oh, that makes no sense. But there was a time when there were philosophers, authors who would say, God did always govern his own people by monarchy only. There is not in all the scripture mention or approbation of any other form of government, right? This is what they would say. Like for a long time, there was just no other way of, conceiving of government. And the text that we're going through today, in 1 Samuel, those were the bedrock passages that were used to offer this justification. So how could a monarchy be bad if you can, when you read the text and you see what Samuel and Saul and David and Solomon are doing, how could this be a bad thing? I mean, it's so compelling that if you think about it, even in our modern world, the most technologically advanced country in the history of the world still has a monarchy as its form of government. This is Wakanda. They are just futuristic and somehow still have not only a monarchy, but the way they do succession in Wakanda is two people fight for it, and the winner becomes the king. That's incredible. That's how much we love monarchy. You can have all the other advances in society, but we'll retain that kind of stuff. And you know, you love it. Again, it's easy to be like, oh yeah, that's so silly. But admit, you're like, oh, I do like the idea of like a big, strong man who can be the leader of my country and guide us into the future. Many of us actually feel feel the tension on the opposite end, right? Like recently, you know, I think a few Sparkers even participated in this No Kings protest. They're, you know, part of the idea there, of course, like there's this like, you know, practical, specific idea of opposing what the people who are protesting perceive as like authoritarian overreach within American government behavior. That's more like what a king does, not what somebody who oversees a democracy does, right? But part of the vibe, the underlying current in something like that is like, oh, that's not America. We got rid of kings because they're bad for so many reasons, and that's not how we do it. So, and again, I think that for some of the people who are involved in these kinds of protests, sometimes they're trying to, like, if you're a Christian involved in those protests, you are trying to think through, you know, what, like, for the people who search the biblical text for what kind of government is best, or what does God actually think about kings? How should I think about, like, you know, authoritarian leaders in my world? I think it's good to wrestle with what do we think the, you know, this stretch of text is actually saying. It raises, I think, for us a very good question of, like, to king or not to king. Like, look, is this thing that the Bible is describing inherently bad? Is it inherently good? How should I read these stories? How should I feel about, like, these stories about King David? Does it tell me anything about the type of ruler or leader of my own country that I should look for today? And I want to sit with that tension a little bit as we go through the text, because what I've presented so far is the main positive narrative in scriptures, the way people have often interpreted it, that establishes the idea that yes, a king, like having a king, having a monarchy, is part of God's plan for God's people. And through it, God was able to establish permanent kingdom forever with a king, a descendant of David, that would rule forever. So there's that thread. And now let's embrace the counter thread that occurs within this same text, okay? So it first shows up, actually, when the people ask Samuel for a king. So in that text it says, but when they said, give us a king to lead us, this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord, and the Lord told him, listen to all the people that are saying to you, it is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. As they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights. Okay? So immediately you see God and Samuel have deep, possibly fundamental reservations about this whole idea. And this is really interesting for us too, because the text is going to offer, propose some reasons why this, asking for a king, wanting a king, having a monarchy might seem inherently bad or inherently antithetical to the goals that God is trying to establish through Israel. Here's what it says. This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants, your male and female servants, and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and yourselves will become his slaves. And when that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. Okay. Now, that seems to be in direct tension with a lot of the threads that we've covered so far. And it also raises this idea that will occur throughout this stretch of, you know, Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, where basically the underlying threat is, you know, when you have a king, you serve the king and the king's interests, and so much of your life becomes upholding the king industrial complex. When you run an empire, then it's all about protecting and saving that empire rather than protecting and saving people from the empire. That is the concern here. So this is actually in the coronation day itself for Saul. So Samuel is overseeing this coronation. And this is what he says. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought Israel up out of Egypt, and I delivered you from the power of Egypt and all the kingdoms that oppressed you. But you have now rejected your God who saves you out of all of your disasters and calamities. And you have said, no, appoint a king over us. That's what he said on coronation day. They're celebrating Saul becoming king. And Samuel's taking the time to just really jab them for what they're asking for. Then there's like a few verses in between where they like have trouble finding Saul. And then they find him, and then like they coronate him. And then the people shout, long live the king. That's how this whole stretch is going. It is a mess. And then like a little bit after that in the text, you already have the people in Israel showing an awareness of like, okay, perhaps this is a bad idea, because this is what they say. Then all the people said to Samuel, pray to the Lord your God for our servants so that we will not die, for we have added to all our other sins the evil of asking for a king. So even they feel a tension within what they're asking for. And then so like with all of the promise that Saul had. So again, it's easy to like to foreshadow how terrible this is going to be. But if you're actually reading those first few chapters of 1 Samuel, there's a lot of potential in Saul. He like the text presents him as humble from the tribe of Benjamin. He describes it as an insignificant tribe. The Spirit of God comes upon Saul, and the text even says God changed Saul's heart to make him like fit to be a king. So they this didn't have to go poorly inherently, right? Like that's the way the text is setting it up. But ultimately, in the case of Saul, there's this trajectory of never fully being able to follow through on what God asked Saul to do, half measures when there should have been full measures, and then because of his failures, ultimately spiraling into paranoia, and then his kingdom collapses in on itself. Like this is a very sad, like tragic ending to how that goes. We'll cover more of that next week when we talk about David. But there is like in this reflection of like Saul's reign, the text actually says it has God saying, I regret that I have made Saul king because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions. The text says Samuel was angry and he cried out to the Lord all the night. So in this kind of reading, it is, I think it's reasonable to kind of look back on it and say, oh, yeah. The problem here is Saul, like Saul himself, because after all, David comes after him, and David was a great king. David was able to accomplish what God asked David to do. So you could end up in this way of reading 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings of like doing basically like character studies, right? And this is actually how, like when I first became a Christian, I was in high school, and I learned like how my hometown church taught the United Monarchy period to kids in Bible class. And it was like, this is how they did it. It's like, you remember there's King Saul, he's sad. He did not do what God wanted. Then there was King David. He did great. And then there was Solomon. It's like, oh, that's kind of iffy. We'll get to that in a few weeks. But this is the idea, right? And what is actually happening here, right, is it's saying, these are not like neutral or factual statements about like how to read this portion of the text. What this is doing is taking a particular lens of like character studies of like, or like hero studies and saying like, okay, let's evaluate each of these individual heroes, these big strong men, and let's see like, did they live up to, you know, to what God asked them to do? In which ways did they not do it? What can we learn about how to be, you know, better than they did? What can we learn from their mistakes and their positive examples? And I get that. I understand the value in trying to seek that kind of knowledge and learning and insight from the text. I enjoy these kinds of explorations around big strong men. As a big strong man myself, you know, I think it's a worthwhile pursuit. So for the podcast, people, just so you know, the people in the audience were laughing because they can see me and they don't perceive neither a big nor strong nor man person speaking to them. So that's where that was coming for the record. Actually, as a side note, as I was writing out some notes and I wrote the line like, as a big strong man myself, my word processor auto-corrected. It was like, did you mean a big wrong man? And I was like, oh, you got me, word processor. But the idea here is like, this is a very normal way that like we talk about these kinds of texts and these kinds of characters. I have been in many men's Bible studies, like over the course of, you know, the years, where the whole thing is like, all right, let's read about the story of David. Like, you know, let's learn about like all of the ways that he was good and bad and all of that kind of stuff. And I think that approach, it has some merit, but it can often be misguided for a variety of ways. And part of that is, you know, we all, again, like you may look at that and be like, oh yeah, right. What an absurd, like hero worshipy way to do this. But we all do this. We all love to understand history through like big, significant individuals and heroes. And it comes at a cost, I believe. So there's actually in like studies about history, like how people do history, you know, historiography, there is this idea of like, okay, you know what? You know, an important, really good, best way is to like understand history. It's the great man theory of history. It's like our best way to understand like who we are as a people, where we've come, is through these like these individuals. It's like in our modern era, I think the way that it, like the underlying philosophy, you know, has been put forward based on like, you know, the teachings like this Scottish historian from the 1800s who said like universal history, the history of what man has accomplished in this world, is at bottom the history of the great men who have worked here. They were the leaders of men, these great ones, the modelers, patterns, and in a wide sense, creators of whatsoever the general mass of men contrived to do or attain. The soul of the whole world's history, it may justly be considered, were the history of these. Okay, now it's easy for you to look at that and be like, oh, or hero worship much, and like think about how that's an absurd way. But you do this. We all do this. Like this is one of the easiest ways to try to make sense of the world around us. It comes up very practically. Even if you like, I'm a fan of the NBA. There's literally debates within like among NBA fans about what's the best way to talk about the history of the NBA. And there are people who like so firmly believe, oh, the best way to tell the history of the NBA is through this big strong man theory of history, where like you just pick the best, like the key player of that era, you tell the story through them. And I just, you know, the anti-hero worship part of me just writhes against this type of perspective for many reasons, but especially because those debates often overlook who I actually think is the hero through whom we should be able to tell the story, is Steph Curry. It's like, why is he not the big strong man through whom we tell this story, right? So this is like, there's like many reasons to feel that challenge. But again, in our pop culture, we do this all the time. Like we, you know, Team of Rivals, written by a historian like Doris Kearns Goodwin, got like huge praise when it came out. People love presidential biographies. And one of the criticisms that often comes out with these books and the movies that they're based on is that the author themselves seems to be like biased in like portraying this person inevitably in like through this lens of like having so much more influence than they actually did. are being more flawed than they actually are. I know that you should feel more of that kind of dissonance with Hamilton. That's actually, so Hamilton the musical was, Lin-Manuel Miranda adapted it from a book, like a history book about Alexander Hamilton. One of the criticisms of both the musical and the book was that it portrays Hamilton in a very positive way, and it is veering into hero worship in the way that it tells it, but you all loved it. I know this is a part of how you understand American history. History right now is through that musical, right? We can't help this, how this happens. So another way that this shows up in my world in particular, some of you know that I'm a consumer psychologist, and especially in entertainment. So one of the things that I think about is these trends in who are the people that consumers go to for entertainment. And this is one of the charts that we were looking into at work where we were looking at, like, okay, we're actually noticing a trend where more and more people are going to, like, thought leaders. They're like own worlds, like big strong men, to like really understand the world as their source of authority on a variety of topics. What you see in this chart is like the size of the audiences of these various thought leaders out there in the in the world of online shows. Red is the audiences that are conservative or Republican. Blue is the audiences that are Democrat, right? So you can interpret, like, you can draw all kinds of conclusions from it. But one of the things that is clearly happening is that many of us are going to individuals who seem so cool and so compelling and so inspiring, and going to them for, like, our source of knowledge, and they become the person through whom we understand the world. That is a problem. Like, that is exactly the part of the concern with this this way of looking at hero worship. One of the things that I love about what the Bible text does to provide, like, a subversive critique of this, like, hero worship approach is actually in the way that we, like, actually structure the Bible itself, the canon. Like, how do we group the books together? What categories do they give it? Because so far, right, you can think of, like, oh, this is, you know, like, the First and Second Samuel, First and Second Kings and Chronicles. These are the stories of great men and all their triumphs and all their flaws. So it's understandable where that would come from, right? Like, so this is how we've been going through the text so far in Garden to Garden, right? We just finished the law, the first five books of the Bible. Now we're in what, through, like, Christian tradition, in the way it's structured, the Old Testament, we call it the history section. So this is, like, what the canon has looked like for, you know, the majority of, the, like, Christian history. And then you can see we're in First and Second Samuel right now. There's also the next section would be wisdom. Like, that's what we call that section, and then finally there's the prophets section. So does that seem familiar to you? Like, that's kind of how the structure of the Bible, and then here's where we are. It's not a neutral statement to call that section history, right? So First and Second Samuel does fit multiple genres. Like, it's important to be aware of that. The genres that I think we often recognize very easily are some of the ones we've talked about so far. First and Second Samuel does, in fact, fit, like, among its, you know, contemporary documents that existed among ancient Israel's neighbors around the time this was written. It was very common for kingdoms to write basically, like, royal histories or, like, royal military histories. The whole purpose of those were to describe all of the, you know, victories of the king, to grant that kingdom military legitimacy. That was the whole point. And First and Second Samuel is doing a lot of that. Another point in those stories was to do, it's like this epic hero story. That's part of what this text is doing, where it's like telling these, like, great stories of the heroes of your kingdom, like, you know, around the time that it was established. But it is also doing what this text in particular, First and Second Samuel, is doing, another genre that it fits into, is what's called prophetic counter-narrative. It's where the story that it's telling is actually from the perspective of prophets who are actually against the entire thing, against the military-industrial complex, against using force to legitimize power, and against hero worship. And that is what's happening in 1st and 2nd Samuel. So there are many things I love about the traditional way that we've historically developed the Christian canon. One of which, this is probably you're curious about it if you saw ones you didn't recognize. This is a bonus content for subscribers only Catholics. You get not only the Protestant ones we're familiar with, but some of these other ones as well, which are great. But what's interesting is the Hebrew version of the Old Testament that existed like around Jesus's time groups the books a little differently, and traditionally they use different categories for it than we do. And in particular, it changes where 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings fit. It's not a neutral statement that, so in the traditional way that the Hebrew Bible is structured, there are three parts, and 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings are in the section called prophets. And I love that because I think what it's doing is centering the fact that even though these stories look like they're about these big heroes who are all about who they conquered, is actually about the prophets. At its core, it is a prophetic story. There's an Old Testament scholar, Walter Brueggemann, who actually passed away just like very recently, like days ago, who is one of the leading voices in helping interpreters understand and see this prophetic counter narrative that occurs within this, like, you know, what seems like this big praise of monarchy, where he actually says this as part of it. He says, Samuel's problem with Saul is not that he had a personal dislike for him. Rather, Samuel sensed that monarchy threatened the very character of Israel as a covenantal community. It placed in jeopardy the special experiment that was Israel. It is only incidental that Saul happens to be the one in office at the time. So you see how, like, if you were taking a hero worship character-driven lens to the text, you'd be like, oh, Saul failed because of his personal failings. Like, he made this decision, and that's what happened. And then you would look at David. David succeeded because he did this and this and this, and he didn't do that. Solomon failed or his ambiguous outcome because of, like, these types of things. And you would miss what I think is an actual critique that Samuel is levying against the whole thing. Being like, this is a problem, this is less than ideal. Yes, God can work through kings, but that is not how it is intended to be. And I think that this is actually helpful for us to remember as well. Because, like, would you be able to say this about your political leader in your country today? Would you ever be able to say, like, oh, my problem is not that I have a personal dislike of that candidate, whether this individual candidate who's in charge right now, that's incidental. I actually have a structured critique of the entire system. That doesn't come up in most of my conversations with many of us about politics. And I'm sad that that's the case, because I think that as a church, we are missing out on that prophetic voice where we can be there to critique whoever is in charge, no matter what, with the same level of fervor that Samuel is doing in the birth of the monarchy that he established here. It is a very hard thing to do, to pull yourself out of character-driven political analysis and actually think like a prophet of God, about and asking deep questions about why this country is the way that it is and what followers of Jesus are called to do because of it. In establishing this counter-prophetic narrative, I think it starts in a very beautiful place within the text of 1st and 2nd Samuel itself. So, like all good subversive threads, like many good subversive threads throughout the Bible, this one starts with a woman who, unlike those around her, can see the world for the way that it truly is. So when I started talking about this text, we kind of jumped into like when Samuel was a prophet and judge and military leader. But the text actually begins before he's born, and it begins with his mom before she's a mom. And it starts from her praying to God to have a child when she can't. And she promises to God that if she could have a child, that she would dedicate that child in service to the Lord. So God gives her Samuel. And then she prays a prayer in the early chapters of 1st and 2nd Samuel that scholars will say it sets the tone for this entire section of the Bible for how to think about monarchy, like how to think about all these kings that will come after, the ones that we call good, the ones that we call bad, and so on. This is the prayer, Hannah's prayer, that she prays. Part of it goes, "My heart rejoices in the Lord. In the Lord, my strength is lifted high. My mouth boasts over my enemies, for I delight in your deliverance. The bows of the warriors are broken, but those who stumbled are armed with strength. Those who were full hire themselves out for food, but those who were hungry are hungry no more." This is her vision for what should be at the center of any kinds of discussions about who is in charge of Israel. Later in the text, she says, "The Lord raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. The Lord seats them with the princes and has them inherit a throne of honor. It is not by strength that one prevails. Those who oppose the Lord will be broken. The Most High will thunder from heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth." That's the center, right? Whatever lens you're going to do to like read through all of the chapters that are coming up for all of the kings that you'll read, you start here and you end here with what is your way of evaluating these leaders. Samuel does this himself. So this is him when talking about retirement. So he's getting old. He's transitioning. Saul is their king now. Look at how, this is a great, it's one of those themes in the text that are really cool. It's like, did the child listen to his mama? And this is an example. So he's done with his career. Look at how he talks about what he accomplished during his time as Israel's leader. He says, "Now you have a king as your leader. As for me, I'm old and gray, and my sons are here with you. I have been your leader from my youth until this day. Here I stand. Testify against me in the presence of the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Whom have I cheated? Whom have I oppressed? From whose hand have I accepted a bribe to make me shut my eyes? If I have done any of these things, I will make it right." That was a leader after God's own heart. And this is how Samuel reflects on his own time. Another thread that connects to this that I really love that carries through to the New Testament is there is another woman in a similar circumstance, in the sense that she doesn't have a child. She is told by God that she will, and in learning that, sings a song of praise that sets the tone for how God will deliver Israel through that child. And that is Mary. So many scholars have pointed out strong parallels between the song that Mary sings when she learns about what's going to happen through Jesus and the song that Hannah sang. Almost all scholars are saying it's a conscious connection to say, all right, we've got a king on the horizon, but let's remember what it actually looks like when God is in charge. And this is how these are parts of Mary's song that are dead parallels for what Hannah prays. She says, "My soul glorifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior. God has performed mighty deeds with God's arm. God has scattered those who are proud in their inmost thoughts. God has brought down rulers from their thrones and has lifted up the humble. God has filled the hungry with good things, but has sent the rich away empty." One of the ways that, you know how we've been talking about this text in 1 and 2 Samuel is very similar to the other genres that other texts existed contemporary to the time for Israel. They also told, military stories to legitimize their government. They also told heroic narratives to praise their heroes. One of the things that the Bible does quite a bit that's different from a lot of those others is it actually presents all of those kings and rulers with their deep flaws, like fundamentally bad decisions and moral corruption that they exhibited. There's this thread within it to say we're telling some hero stories, but these aren't the ultimate heroes. The ultimate heroes are the ones who do this. And it's very different from the stories and expectations that we have for the big, strong men back in Israel's time and in our time today. And again, it just like Samuel in this case, you can ask Jesus, did Jesus listen to his mama? And then you see the, like in his own sermons, like from the, just a few chapters later in Luke, when Jesus preaches, he says, blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. But woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and you will weep. This is what it looks like to have a prophet who is dedicated to being a prophet no matter who's in charge. If your political rage turns on and off every 4 years, depending on which leader happens to be in charge, I would say we're not living up to the calling of a prophet of God. And if you feel like it's the end of the world, but only if it's the candidate that you hate who gets elected, then again, I think you're getting caught up in the highs and lows of whatever big strong man happens to be in charge at the same time. The current, if the current big strong man is the source of your anxiety, and if the other big strong man or woman was in charge, then your anxiety would be relieved. Again, I think we're missing the prophetic counter narrative that's going on. Like we talked about last week, we sang a song together that is that would effectively apply here too, where it's like, look, God gave you that joy that you have. There's no big strong man, no political candidate, no political party that can take that away from you. And a prophet knows that and anchors on that through everything. There's no big strong man coming to save you. If anything, a key prophetic theme is in Samuel and Kings, it's actually that those big strong men will ultimately destroy each other. And to be a follower of Jesus, to live up to that prophetic calling he has invited us all into, is to hold every big strong man accountable in such a way that they are afraid of us, not the other way around. Make it so that no political leader of any party can comfortably count on you for their support, because they know that your allegiance is to Jesus, who came to make the comfortable uncomfortable. This is our time together now where we center our story around Jesus, who showed us that there is a wholly opposite way to think about what it looks like for God to be in charge and for God to be a king. And it comes through the tradition that Jesus handed to his disciples, and that we've carried on to this day, where we do communion together. And as the tradition goes, for in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, take, eat, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. Likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me.